Leo Catskill.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, measles alert. Sullivan County issues a health advisory following a nearby outbreak with confirmed cases in neighboring Orange County. No local cases in Sullivan County identified, but they're ramping up preparedness efforts, including securing testing kits and coordinating with state health authorities. Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government joins us with more, plus the latest from the Sullivan County Legislature. The Deepwater Literary Festival returns to Narrowsburg with a powerful lineup of writers, musicians, and artists next month, exploring themes of transformation. Festival director Aaron Hicklin joins us to give us a preview. And the latest episode of our new theater podcast, Curtain Call, is out today. We'll hear more from the host, producer Tom Candela. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The U.S. Supreme Court says that former Justice David Souters died at the age of 85. Souter was appointed by former President George H.W. Bush in 1990 and won Republican backing. But Souter surprised many by often siding with liberal justices. Souter retired in 2009. Pope Leo XIV celebrated the first Mass of his new papacy today in the Vatican's Sistine Chapel. The Vatican says he will be officially installed in a Mass on Sunday, May 18th. Russia is marking the 80th anniversary of the Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany in World War II. Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke to crowds gathered in Moscow.
Today, all of us are united by feelings of joy and sadness, of pride and gratitude. We bow our heads to the generation that crushed the Nazism. At the cost of millions of lives, they won peace and freedom for the whole of humanity.
He was heard here through a BBC interpreter, but Putin's remarks are being overshadowed by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The Trump administration is officially granting refugee status to more than 50 white South Africans. As Kate Bartlett reports, they're expected to begin arriving in the U.S. next week.
The group of white South Africans could arrive at Dulles Airport as early as Monday, three sources with knowledge of the matter told NPR, which has also seen an email confirming the arrangements. The sources all work for the U.S. government, so did not want to be named out of fear of retribution. This comes just 3 months after President Trump signed an executive order claiming Afrikaners face persecution in South Africa and could apply for refugee status in the United States. Afrikaners are the descendants of mainly Dutch colonists. The South African government says there is no evidence they are being persecuted and has accused the U.S. administration of being taken in by disinformation. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
Stocks opened higher this morning as the U.S. and China prepare for trade talks. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow's up about 100 points.
U.S. officials will be meeting with their Chinese counterparts in Geneva this weekend. In a social media post this morning, President Trump floated the idea of reducing the tariff on Chinese goods from 145 to 80%. That would still be a much higher import tax than the U.S. has typically levied. China says exports to the U.S. dropped more than 20% last month after Trump intensified his trade war. China found other markets for its products, however. The country's overall exports continue to climb. The trade war is keeping some international travelers from visiting the U.S. The travel website Expedia says bookings to the U.S. from Canada have dropped by nearly 30%. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. A federal judge holds a hearing today in Vermont for a Tufts University doctoral student. The Trump administration is seeking to deport Remeza Ozturk. A federal appeals court has already ordered the administration to take Ozturk out of detention in Louisiana and move her to Vermont while her case is decided. Ozturk has not been charged with any crime. She published an essay criticizing her university over the war in Gaza. Some states are passing new laws that make it harder for voters to place issues on their ballots. NPR's Ashley Lopez reports Republican lawmakers leading these efforts say they are working to reduce fraud.
Kelly Hall is with the Fairness Project, a group that uses ballot measures to pass economic and social justice policies. She says laws limiting citizen-led ballot initiatives are not new, but her group is seeing more of them this year than ever before.
That is in no small measure, I think, a response to the high-profile nature of reproductive rights ballot measures.
Republican-led governments in Arkansas and Florida have already passed such laws, which they say prevents groups misleading voters and fraud. Both states had citizen-led efforts last year aimed at getting abortion rights protections passed through ballot measures. The new restrictions in both states are also being challenged in court. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
India and Pakistan have continued to attack each other. They've used drones, projectiles, and military aircraft. They've struck areas that have not been hit in about half a decade. India began the latest round saying it was retaliating for the killing of 26 tourists. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us, and happy Friday. Happy Friday to Dan Hoost as well, who joins us every Friday. He's the communications director from Sullivan County Government, and he's here live in studio. Hello.
Hello, and hello to everybody who's listening. This past week, I have had, I think, close to a dozen different people say that they listen and hear what I have to say on Friday. Thankfully, they said they liked it, too. But it was really a meaningful thing to have that many people come up to me and say, oh, we look forward to hearing the county report.
Are we going to have to start going through your agent?
No, but I will charge for autographs.
All right. Well, let's start with something that's a serious health advisory. Measles alert. There are 3 confirmed cases in neighboring Orange County, none in Sullivan County. But that's prompted Sullivan County Health to issue an advisory. What's the latest there?
Basically, we want to stay ahead of this. That's why our public health director, Dr. Jesse Moore, had me issue the press release yesterday, just to especially let healthcare providers and summer camp operators know it's in the neighborhood. Mm. It came from overseas, but it's in very young children, including a child who is otherwise actually too young to be vaccinated, but is part of a family that is fully vaccinated. So we're very hopeful that it's not going to spread. Orange County's health folks are responding very aggressively and quickly to it. So we have full faith and confidence in them, but measles can be a pernicious little critter. Just like the little critters that it likes to attack are children and babies, although it can pose a risk as well to people who are older or who have compromised immune systems. Mm. But for us in particular, we just wanted to let the whole populace know, but again, especially our healthcare operators and our camp operators, that this is here and you need to be very vigilant in how you handle potentially infectious diseases and your processes that you have for dealing with vaccination and watching out for measles, mumps, rubella, all that stuff, because it can spread very quickly in especially like a summer camp setting.
We had heard about the measles outbreak in Texas and in the southwest of the United States, but in this case, these have been identified as children under the age of 1 who were traveling internationally.
Yes.
And because they were of that age, they're too young to be eligible for the measles vaccination. So
correct.
That's what happened there. Alerting healthcare providers, alerting summer camps. What about the general public?
Well, the general public, we have information available in the press release and on the public health website, basically asking folks, you know, check your immunity. If you're unsure of your vaccination status, you can request a measles titer, it's called, from your healthcare provider. It's a simple blood test that can confirm whether you're protected. Anyone born after 1957 should have documentation of 2 measles, mumps, rubella doses or a positive titer. Those without documented immunity are encouraged to get vaccinated. And, of course, be cautious and vigilant with people who are very, very young, pregnant, weakened immune systems. They're at the highest risk for severe complications. The vaccine is safe and effective. I put something out. We already had some people saying, oh, check on this because it might not be. Now, it's very, very much time-tested and proven. This vaccine has been around for decades. So it is, as I said, safe and effective. But of course, also just practice your usual good hygiene, hand washing, avoid close contact with sick individuals. And of course, stay informed. We will be putting more information out there, including through WJFF, if people need to know more.
There's some detailed information about, you know, what you need to know at our website as well from that release at WJFFradio.org. In the legislature yesterday, more discussion about the proposed homeless shelter that could lead to another public hearing, it seems. What's the latest there?
Yes, that'll be dependent, of course, on what happens at the full board meeting next week. And the public hearing, I think, only requires what we would call a simple majority to schedule, which is 5 votes. However, after that, if they decide to move forward with this lease with Honor, a Middletown-based homeless advocacy and assistance organization, to operate and also to build this facility on Pitaluga Road in Monticello, that would need a supermajority of 6 or more legislators. They didn't get that last time, and it's not at all certain that they're going to get it this time, at least with this location, because that's what this particular, quote, revote and re-public hearing is focused on. So there was a lot of discussion about that. There continues to be a lot of debate amongst legislators as to whether this, A, is the proper location, whether, B, this is the proper approach, whether, C, this is sufficient, whether, D, we should even be in this to begin with. Although there is, we have a legal, and I would argue too, a moral responsibility as the local government to make sure that we are at least aiding our neediest and most vulnerable. I don't think any of the legislators disagree with that. They just have differing ideas on how to go about doing that.
The legislators heard from Commissioner John Little about that, who presented a cost-benefit analysis. What did that benefit analysis say, and what were some of the myths that he was able to dispel as well?
Well, one of the things that really resonated with me is this idea that this stigma that we put on homeless people, that they are all a criminal element. They're like the rest of humanity. There is some that's a criminal element, but most people are good people, not looking to harm or hurt anybody else. And we're thrown into very bad situations through something that may not have even been their fault. Because that's the other stigma, is that, well, they're to blame for being homeless. There was a woman there who spoke yesterday to legislators saying, I couldn't do my rent payments anymore because the rent had gone up so high and my landlord evicted me. And he was within his rights to do that, but she didn't have any place to go except family and friends. So while we might technically say, well, then you're not homeless, you're staying with family and friends, she wants her own place. She doesn't have that. Another thing that he was talking about with the homeless shelter is it's temporary. It's transitionary. This is not a place for people to go stay and live for a long time. If I recall correctly, it was going to be no more than a month stay at any given time, and then you have to be out of there. You can't stay. This is not meant to be permanent accommodations. His argument is that it's a better alternative for people than putting them in hotels. Although, of course, there were legislators who also brought up the fact that this would just be for single men and single women, and they're concerned about what about the families and the children that we might still be putting in local hotels. So this is a real debatable issue in certain ways about between people who still care about the situation, but like I said, have different opinions on this. And of course, then there's the cost, $8 million. That's a big pill for people to swallow. But then there's also the idea that, well, some people had said, like, let's buy one of the local hotels and rehab that. That would cost a lot more than that, especially to bring it up to the state standards that's necessary, as opposed to building new. So, but I would say stay tuned at this point, because there's going to be more conversation about it next week. And that's when the rubber's going to meet the road. Are they going to move forward with this, or are they not going to move forward with this? Oh, and one thing I wanted to mention too, and you might be mentioning it yourself here in a second, John Little's presentation, I'm going to make that available on the website today. It is extremely informative, including, like you said, that cost-benefit analysis.
Well, he said that the shelter, that $8 million cost could potentially pay for itself in about 12 years.
Yes.
Also explained who's actually housed there, which you touched on a little bit. There seems to be some disinformation floating around about who's actually there. Folks maybe thinking that there are undocumented folks that are there, or folks from New York City that have been bused in.
That is not true. John went in detail about that. Legislator Kat Scott asked him specific pointed questions to get answers to that. Those folks are not receiving those kinds of benefits. Listen, we're not going to leave anybody out in the cold, regardless of their citizenship status. But when it comes to these kinds of benefits and this kind of transitionary homeless shelter, that's not an option to them. That's not a benefit. This is to benefit Sullivan County people who, for different reasons, from mental health to just unfortunate circumstances, are homeless.
The next public hearing is set for June 19th on the shelter. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday. A discussion yesterday about waste management. Tipping fees are going up on July 1st. The Seneca Meadows contract is set to expire. What's the latest with the garbage in Sullivan County?
Well, it continues to be a topic of interest and concern, not just to legislators, but also to the members of the public. There's a small, but actually rather starting to grow, a group of local folks who are coming that are concerned about the county's consideration of a waste-to-energy plant. Now, what I would say to that is there are still the county isn't in a place to even have a public hearing or say this is what we're going to do about a waste-to-energy plant. There will be many more opportunities for public comment. There's more information legislators have to figure out about this before they would move forward. But they are interested in talking about it further. And at least from my personal perspective, that kind of research is valuable, because it may be that they find that they don't want to move forward with this, as some of the public is asking them not to do. But to say just don't do it without even looking at it, I think it is not responsible to the taxpayers. We need to at least explore all the different options and figure out there's pros and cons to everything. Because one of the other major options, which may be coming up sooner rather than later, is to ship it out by train or truck out of state. If Seneca Meadows closes, I don't believe there's another landfill in New York State that we can export to. So that has its own costs as well. I remember when I worked in Calicoon and we called it the trash train that would come by. I think it has to be covered in tarp now, but
on the railroad.
Yeah, it used not to be on the railroad. And we would see bits and pieces of trash flying out as it went by. And who wants that going through their community too? So, like I said, everything has pros and cons. I think the public recognizes that as well. But I would say legislators need to be able to look at all the choices in order to make the responsible decision that they can defend to the taxpayers, who are going to be demanding ever more that the county address the solid waste. We're not actually required by law to have a solid waste service at the county level. But legislators, to a person, I think, feel strongly that this is something that we should at least look at providing. There might be, actually, I should correct myself, there might be one or two who might be interested in offloading that to towns or to private haulers, and that may eventually be a more serious discussion too. But right now, the two biggest discussions are the waste-to-energy plant, and the, even if that were to get built, there would have to be something in the interim. What we're going to do
in the meantime,
if Seneca Meadows closes.
Yeah, and a reminder, there's no landfill in Sullivan County, so the county ships its waste currently to Seneca Meadows. That is at capacity. They're looking to get an extension, I believe, from the state, but I think the latest is that they have been told that their application was insufficient, so they have to go back to the drawing board.
Yes.
That means that there's still this contract's still set to expire. DPW says that they might be putting out a bid for a new waste management company. Is that Interstate Waste, I understand, and they ship waste out to other states.
Yes, and Ohio. That's what we have to be looking at, because if Seneca Meadows doesn't get the chance to expand, I believe it's possible as early as the end of this year that they would stop accepting our waste. Well, we can't let that pile up here in Sullivan County. It has to be shipped someplace. So there are some very serious choices that are going to have to be made sooner rather than later, along with some long-term choices that legislators have to be looking at. Mm-hmm. I'm very glad the public is involved in telling them how they feel about it. But I'm also putting out there that legislators, I think, have to and are doing their due diligence on what the choices are.
Let's take a quick break. We'll come back with more from Dan Hoost and the Sullivan County Legislature. They heard yesterday from Hope Alive 845 to talk about their mission to help missing persons. We'll learn more about that after this break. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
On This Old House Radio Hour, Bo Pedersen, better known as Dad Advice from Bo on social media, is on to talk about becoming the internet's dad.
If you had to make a video library that only your kids were going to access, what would you want to record?
Plus, over or under? Is there a right way to hang your toilet paper? And we're taking your calls. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Join us for This Old House Radio Hour from APM, American Public Media.
Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, civil rights lawyer Alec Karakatsanis on the ways in which public safety impacts the criminal justice system. We'll also hear from Wahini Vara, a journalist writing about and with AI. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Let's get back to our conversation with Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday. Hope Alive is an organization that works with missing persons. They had a presentation yesterday in front of the legislature to talk about how they support families and loved ones of missing and trafficked individuals. What were they telling the legislature there yesterday?
That there's a lot of work going on, and they want to expand actually beyond Sullivan County.
More work than you would think.
Yes, there are a lot of missing people, including there was a young woman whose father was the co-founder of this, Mr. Harris. I can't remember his first name, but she's been missing for several years now, and this just personally motivated him to put out there that, listen, I understand what other people are going through. I want to help as much as possible. We're going to be your conduit, if you will, to local law enforcement, to, I think, private investigators, to other families that are dealing with the same thing. I think as much as anything, you know, they're not law enforcement. They're just a nonprofit.
Right.
They are there to help people cope with the unexplained loss of a loved one. You think about the death of someone is difficult, but you know, they passed away. They were buried or cremated or whatever. There is some sense of closure, if you will, to that. There is no sense of closure with people who have gone missing or with remains that have been found that are unidentified. And that's what Hope Alive 845, which has a website and a hotline too, that goes right to, I think, Mr. Harris's cell phone, exists for, is to be that place of hope that there are other people who, even if they can't find your loved one for you, are going to hold your hand for as long as you need that hand held. They'll give you a hug, literally and figuratively, for as long as you need that. And they are all about never forgetting that that person is missing and to do something, whatever is possible, about it. And our legislator, Kat Scott, was so moved by that that she wanted to have a proclamation that was put out. I'll be posting that later today on social media, along with a photo of her giving it, basically saying how pleased and grateful we were for Hope Alive 845 and declaring May to be, I believe it's Missing and Unidentified Persons Month in Sullivan County.
Are they trying to work with the legislature and the sheriff's office and other law enforcement to establish a missing persons unit?
They're talking about that. They're talking about funding. Where it's going to land, I'm not exactly sure, but they definitely were there not just to bring awareness, but to see ways that the county could come alongside and partner with them about that. You know, I don't want to cast aspersions on any of our local police saying they aren't looking for these people or somehow aren't doing their job. And I don't think Hope Alive 845 either is looking to do that. What I'm saying is that they're looking at whatever ways the county or sheriff's office, other police departments are amenable to us partnering together. In fact, I think they spoke very highly of Sheriff Schiff, who has been present at some of their press conferences and supports what they're doing. So if there is a way with a missing persons unit or some funding that we can find for them, I think legislators would be amenable to doing that. That wasn't settled on yesterday, more so it was just to bring awareness.
Let's talk about some key dates coming up. That Citizens Preparedness Class is coming up May 20th at the Emergency Operations Center.
Yeah, 6:30. This is something where I heard somebody say, well, I don't know, it sounds like I'd be watching paint dry. No, it is actually not boring. I am familiar with it. I haven't taken the course myself, but I've seen the materials and what they talk about. It is extremely timely. It is very interesting. And it helps remove fear with empowerment, with information, which allows you to make more informed choices, especially in moments of catastrophe, when the power goes out, when a tree crashes down in your yard, when there's a tornado warning issued, when evacuation has to happen, when there's going to be flooding. This will all be tackled in just a couple of hours, 6:30. It starts at our Emergency Operations Center, which is near our county airport. It requires pre-registration, but it is completely free, and you get a free emergency preparedness kit at the end of that. It's very useful. Sullivan County, as I think most of us know, is not immune to disasters, both natural and man-made. This is one of the best investments you can make, and it costs you nothing more than time and whatever gas it takes to get to the EOC.
Summer is coming. Courses are being offered this month to become a lifeguard at local parks. What's the info there?
Yep. You can get your certification. Your Red Cross is working with us. Our parks department has been promoting this. You can go to our website, sullivanny.gov, and look up parks, and you will find the registration form there to take the lifeguard courses. We always are in need of lifeguards, and not just the county. Towns have pools. Cartwright, I'm sure, is hiring for lifeguards as well. And so there's jobs available, especially for young people who are in reasonably fit condition. You don't have to be in peak athletic condition, but it's a great way to get some good job experience and to provide a vital, if not life-saving, service. You know, we have a beach at Lake Superior State Park, but that's only open if and when we have lifeguards to man it. Otherwise, you can't swim there.
Yeah. Fort Delaware, opening May 17th.
Yeah, this is exciting. I remember this from my childhood because the fort has been around since 1957, I believe, is when it first opened as a recreated version of the original Fort Delaware that sat just up the Delaware River a little bit from Narrowsburg. But it's a colonial era fort, and we do our best when you step through those stockaded gates, I think is what they're called, to feel like you've gone back in time 250, 300 years to see what life was like then in all its glory and hardships. And we have interpreters, as we call them, who dress up in period dress. You can watch a blacksmith at work, which is fascinating. Somebody who's doing sewing and weaving. Somebody who shows how they used to load a musket, which is much different from how guns are loaded today. There are exhibits. There's a gift shop. It's all owned by the county and currently operated by the Delaware Company, which is a nonprofit we contract with that includes our county historian, John Conway, and his wife, Debbie, who do an outstanding job of trying to bring that place to life and ever increase the visits. Because while we're glad to have school kids visit on some sort of school trip, we want families and individuals just to stop by. It's right on 97 in Narrowsburg. Be like, what is this place? Find out for a nominal fee you can get in and really find a fascinating range of exhibits. It's not just, here's a fort, walk around it. Mm. You can talk to people. You can see what they're doing. And sometimes we also have special events. Stay tuned. They have their own social media page, which I'll share things from as well. There's lots going to be happening this summer. And it begins in just, what, a week?
May 17th, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the DPW surplus equipment auction. That is basically vehicles or other items that have been put out of service at this point, and you're looking to move them on.
Yep. And most of them have been pretty heavily used. I wouldn't say there's a lot of lightly used things here, but you might be able to find something. Next week is when the auction's going to start. I'll be posting information about that shortly, but I can give a little preview. We have 31, they call them lots. So basically, for example, we've got trucks, pickup trucks and vans and things, mostly around 10 to 15 years old, although there is a mower here that goes back to 1999. There's trailers. There's a snowblower. There's brush hogs. There's, I've never heard of this, a hay blower. I'm sure farmers know what that is. I'm embarrassed to admit I don't. But we also have things other than vehicles. We have a shop lathe. We have containers, big, those landfill containers that you see at the transfer station where we load them onto trucks and take them. We have those available. We have,
In case you need one.
Yeah, we have a roller. We have, here's something, concrete test equipment. It's a concrete compression machine, a soil shaker, and an aggregate screen shaker. For you and me, I'm not sure that we would need that, but I mean, bet you there's somebody out there.
Somebody might want them, and you know, it's never too early to shop for the holidays.
Yeah, so we'll have photos. It'll be all tied to a website that will be going up early next week.
Couple shout outs before we go. Division of Management and Budget, another award.
Yeah, this is wonderful. Well, the Treasurer's Office gets one in the fall, but the Division of Management and Budget also gets one. This is for a distinguished budget presentation. This is how we put the budget together to show to the public and to legislators how we're planning to spend money. And this was for the 2025 version, and it goes to the Government Finance Officers Association, a national trade organization that represents, obviously, government finance officers. It's considered their top award. We competed with 1,700 other municipalities, and we were of only a few, actually, that got this Distinguished Budget Presentation Award. We've gotten it for 10 years in a row, but this is particularly sweet for our brand new division commissioner, Anna Marie Novello. So a shout out to her.
Congratulations. It's also National Corrections Officers and Employees Week.
Yes. And boy, our folks who work at the Sullivan County Jail, we are so appreciative of them. We have been so fortunate and lucky now to also get a crop of new hires from the state correctional system for reasons we are very aware of. And we're hoping to give them a really great berth at the jail and really to have more people just to, so that our existing officers and the new people too can go home, go on vacation, spend time with their families and not always be mandated on overtime.
When are the Communication Directors Awards?
I think there are some, but I find I'm competing with like the folks who do for Procter and Gamble or Coca-Cola. Yeah.
We're going to start a campaign. Dan, who's Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend.
My pleasure.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, the Deepwater Literary Festival returns to Narrowsburg next month. We get a preview from festival organizer Aaron Hicklin next. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
Hey, Donna Fellenberg here. Please join me and my guest, blues guitarist and naturalist Scott Weiss, this week on Catskill Character. We talk about his farming family in New Jersey, the House of Music recording studio, touring with his band, the Scott Weiss Band, hiking the long path, and so much more. So don't miss Catskill Character, Saturday at 10:30 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Since its launch in 2018, the Deepwater Literary Festival has drawn some of the most celebrated names in contemporary literature, and this year is no exception. With a theme of metamorphosis and transformation, the 2025 festival welcomes authors like Douglas Stewart, Susan Choi, and Marlon James, alongside dancers, visual artists, and musicians for a weekend of bold conversations and boundary-crossing performances. Joining us today is Aaron Hicklin, founder and director of Deepwater, to talk about this year's highlights, the power of storytelling, and what it means to create a world-class literary event on a river town on the edge of New York and Pennsylvania. Hello.
Hey, Tim.
It's so great to have you here and great to be talking about Deepwater again. And it is just a really great thing to have in our neck of the woods. Let's talk about this year's theme, metamorphosis and transformation. What inspired that choice?
Well, talk about metamorphosis and transformation, turning a town of 370 people into a magnet for some of the world's greatest writers, 30 events in 15 venues over two very packed days is in itself a kind of magical feat of transformation. So the festival itself has always been about transformation. Literature is about transformation. And we are, of course, in a very transformative moment, for better and for worse. Transformative, I think, in terms of a kind of public consciousness and awakening and thinking about the planet, thinking about our politics, thinking about our identities, and, of course, the sort of broader sense of instability, which is transformation and metamorphosis.
You have such a diverse, high-profile group of writers and artists. How do you go about curating all of that? You start, I'm sure, right after the last festival ends and go into the next.
Pretty much. Certainly by December of each year, we're really thinking about who might be applicable based on the theme we've come up with, which author's work might represent or resonate with those themes, and also how we interpret the theme, you know, because it's a very loose, it's best for us to be as loose as we can, because often we want to really explore a kind of wide terrain. So metamorphosis just lends itself to lots of ideas and lots of writers as a result.
Let's talk about some of the program highlights. The opening night features a collaboration between poet Marie Howe and composer Ricky Ian Gordon. How did that come about?
So Ricky Ian Gordon is a composer. He writes wonderful operas, quite literally literary operas. I mean, he's taken The Grapes of Wrath and turned that into an opera, for example. So he's already sort of enacting a kind of transformation. He takes these works of literature and turns them into music. I had the great pleasure of meeting Ricky. He wrote an extraordinary memoir during the pandemic. And happened to reach out to me and mention that he lives not too far away, just down the road from Monticello, in Wolf Lake. When he's not in the city, he's up here. I did an event with him. He was a subject of Shelf Life, the podcast and radio show that is hosted by Radio Catskill.
Sundays at noon.
And we got talking about doing something at the festival, and he's a big friend with Marie Howe, a poet who just won the Pulitzer Prize. She wrote an incredibly moving collection of poetry called What the Living Do. And that title itself kind of, I think, really speaks to a kind of emotional resonance. And the poems were really written to her brother, who had died of HIV/AIDS. And they were full of the kind of tender, I would say almost sort of random observations of daily life, from sort of washing the dishes to the way the leaves blow down a particular street. She was sort of recording things for her brother. And Ricky, who lost a lover to AIDS, turned these into incredible vignettes, operatic vignettes. So we have a soprano singer, a pianist, and the poems will be read and then performed as librettos. And part of that evening also involves something that's a very direct representation of metamorphosis, which is Philip Glass's score for Metamorphosis. His own piece will be performed on stage by Kevin Hayes, who's local to Narrowsburg, a Grammy-winning musician. And he's going to take that and reinterpret it. So it's metamorphosis on top of metamorphosis.
It's the literary festival, Deepwater Literary Festival, not just about books, though. We're talking about this incorporation of music. You also incorporate performance and dance and visual art. Why is it important to you to incorporate these different forms of storytelling into the festival?
I think you said it right there. It's always about storytelling, and storytelling in all its forms. It starts with the written word. So, you know, the music wouldn't exist without the lyrics, and the songwriting and the inspiration for it, which is often rooted in literature. The dance, too, comes out of fiction, out of a literary concept. So it's really trying to connect the dots between all these forms, all these art forms, and the word, the story. And I think that makes it much more invigorating, innovative, exciting. I'm used to a lot of literary festivals where you listen to an author talk about a book that they've just published. And there's a lot of, I have a lot of room and time and space for that. I do a lot of those events myself, but I wanted to kind of elevate that experience. So, you know, even with the authors, they're not really talking about their work. They're talking to the theme of the festival. When we had Joyce Carol Oates come a few years ago, she was there to talk about Frankenstein and its meaning for her. You know, this year with Douglas Stewart, who's the author of Shuggy Bane, which won the Booker Prize, and Young Mungo, the sequel, which was a great book. He's on a panel with Susan Choi, another award winner for a National Book Award for Trust Exercise, and Andre Assaman, who wrote Call Me By Your Name, and he's just written a memoir. But all of those writers are exploring themes relevant to metamorphosis. So their books are part of it, but we're really asking them to talk about something bigger than themselves.
One of the other great things about this festival is that about two-thirds of it is free. It's free to the public. Why is accessibility such a priority for you in Deepwater?
I'm sorry. We always felt that our priority was to make literature and literary arts as accessible as possible. We do charge, but only for about six or seven of the events. Most of the performances are free. Some things are by donation. But I think it's really a simple reflection of our effort to be as open and egalitarian as possible, to make sure the barriers to access are as limited as possible. Because we don't want to exclude anyone. And I think particularly we don't want to exclude the young or those who can't afford it. We don't want to exclude people who are like thinking, maybe I want to go, but this price is going to stop me from going. We want people to discover that literature is an exciting space to occupy, and to kind of discover that through something that I think is maybe more inventive than just sitting down with the book. It's a way into that experience.
How have the 370 folks of Narrowsburg responded to hosting such a major cultural festival?
You know, it's really hard to imagine doing this anywhere else. But up here, I mean, it could be another small town, but Narrowsburg, there's such – and I know we talk about this all the time. It's one of the joys of living in the Sullivan Catskills. Narrowsburg is such a welcoming, hardworking community of ambitious people who are ambitious for creating things, creating community engagement, creating kind of eclectic experiences, and it happens – on all sorts of levels, very grassroots levels, from every individual vendor trying to run a store there and do something different to the restaurateurs. And they all pitch in. They all want to be part of the festival.
That's what's so great about it, having worked with you before on this. And again, we're proud to partner with you. Radio Catskill is going to be a media sponsor of this again. So we'll be talking to you more about the upcoming events. But as part of that, just in our limited way, being there and seeing folks participate, there is this energy about let's get this together and put it on. And people are just, I don't know, there's a bit of a lo-fi way of approaching it, even though it's this major cultural event.
Yes.
And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, there's such a great thing about it that everyone's just pitching in.
Yeah.
You're running all around too.
You know, I mean, I think you've really hit it on the head there. I've always felt that there should be room for surprises. And that means room for a little scrappiness at the edges. We live in a remote part of the world. It's not easy to get to Narrowsburg. It's not easy to do all sorts of things because we don't have the resources that you have in a bigger place, in a city. And that means we're really having to be inventive, resourceful, and to deploy everybody and everything that we can in Narrowsburg. So we use, the Lutheran Church as a venue. We use the community garden as a venue. I mean, Thomas Boskett, an artist who lives in Callicoon, is going to camp there for 72 hours. He's creating a shelter. It can be accessible from the beginning of the festival on Friday to the end of the festival on Sunday. You go in, you sit down, you commune with him. You don't say anything. Or you can if you want. And he's going to draw and you're going to draw. And those drawings are going to be placed on, I don't know, maybe it's a washing line of some kind. And that's his idea of transformation. So creating room for local artists and authors, and creating room as well for international authors, has always been part of it. And that means there is both a kind of, I think, sophisticated quality and a homespun quality. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't want to do it with either of those two elements.
Let's remind folks where they can get more information about the festival upcoming.
Yes, deepwaterfestival.com. That's D-E-E-P, festival. DEEP waterfestival.com.
It's early days.
Yeah, it is early for me.
It's June 20th this year. Is that right?
It's, yes, 6 weeks today it starts. Yeah. June 20th, June 21st, June 22nd.
And finally, briefly, what do you think has surprised you most about the growth and impact of this festival?
I think being able to bring major authors to Narrowsburg has been, I wouldn't say that's been a surprise. I always felt we could work to that, but it's been really exhilarating and I think satisfying to see that we can bring talent of that caliber to such a small place. And I know that the authors love it. I get emails after emails saying, I want to come back. This is my favorite festival. And it's all because it's in Narrowsburg.
Yeah, it's in that spot. Aaron Hicklin, Deepwater Literary Festival. More information at deepwaterfestival.com. Coming up in about 6 weeks, June 20th, and we'll be talking to you more. And of course, don't forget Shelf Life here on Radio Catskill, Sundays at noon, hosted by Mr. Hicklin himself. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the latest episode of our theater podcast, Curtain Call. Tom Candela is here with more after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on Science Friday, why push buttons and knobs are making a comeback in your car.
I think there is a tremendous amount of complexity to buttons that we often don't think about.
Plus a caterpillar that lives in the web of its predator.
It seems like a really questionable life choice if you're a caterpillar, but they are doing it and they're making it work.
We make it all work on the next Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Today, from 2 to 4 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
This week in This American Life, fear of sleep. An apartment with so many cockroaches that in the middle of the night, they crawl into the family's ears. A woman whose husband tries to strangle her in his sleep while he is actually asleep. After that, it's hard to go to bed without worrying. And other stories of people scared to fall asleep this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A Curtain Call is our new Radio Catskill podcast about local theater meeting the professional stage. It's hosted and produced by Mr. Tom Candela, who joins us now with a preview of today's episode. Hello.
Good morning, Tim. How are you?
Good. What's on the pod today?
Well, this week I had the pleasure of sitting down with Marshall Schneider and Amanda Walgren from the Catskill Public Theater. Now, they're a very innovative theater. It's actually, this is their second season coming up. And this season, they are incorporating some of the things they learned from the last season that they had. And they have a mobile pay what you wish theater company, which is bringing really powerful stories to some of our local areas. Yeah. So for instance, they're going to be at a brewery. They're going to be at a barbecue joint. And they're going to be at one of our historic estates in our region. So each time they have this this venue, they're going to be producing each of their two performances of each of the three shows at each location. I'm tripping over my
own
words.
You got it.
Yeah.
Well, let's listen to a part of your conversation.
Yep.
And you can hear the full conversation on the Curtain Call podcast.
Absolutely.
At our website, wjffradio.org.
Thank you. Amanda, Marshall, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for including us. We're proud to be here.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited to have both of you here because this is very special. I mean, you're starting basically a new theater company, Marshall, and we want to put it out there for the people, make them aware that you're here. So I'm going to start the question to you first. What inspired the creation of Catskill Public Theater?
I'll just say that I had some economic prosperity that came from my career as a aquaculture specialist, and I decided to apply some of that prosperity to what was essentially my first love, mm-hmm. to an enterprise I could be proud of. And that's really the roots of the Catskill Public Theater.
Okay.
I worked a couple of seasons at Shakespeare in the Park, very inspired by Joe Papp. And, you know, he started the New York Shakespeare Festival on a flatbed truck. The modern version of a flatbed truck was a state-of-the-art mobile stage. And we are the owners of one of those units. And it's at the core of what we're doing because in addition to using it for our own performances, we are renting it to other users. And that rental income is starting to be a meaningful contributor to the cost of putting on free admission, pay what you wish theater.
Well, last winter, Marshall had sent out an email to the UDC network. I saw Marshall's call for asking for somebody to come in and start working with him and doing his dream of the Catskill Public Theater. So I reached out and we've just been working together ever since. And now I'm super happy to be part of the Catskill Public Theater team. We're going into our second season of operation now. Last year was a whole lot of fun. We all worked together really well and have a lot of shared dreams and ideas and hope for what the future can bring for not only Catskill Public Theater, but also what we can provide for our community and where we call home.
You mentioned about the stage and how it's a mobile stage. You are basically going from venue to venue, spending some weeks at each venue. And this season, I believe you have three different locations you'll be performing at, correct?
Correct. So I made the decision to take advantage of the mobile stage. And instead of asking our audience to come to us, bringing our productions to them. So we will be popping up, as it were, in three different locations. The first one being the Catskill Brewery in Livingston Manor, where we'll be for 2 weeks. And then second location, Big Kev's Barbecue in Bethel, has offered to host us and has even been creating a special area for the theater and our tent and audience and stuff. And then the third location is a really interesting mansion estate formerly owned by the Westinghouse family in Goshen, New York.
The live theater outdoors that we had last year at the Roscoe Fireman's Field was just absolutely amazing. As the sun went down behind the stage and you heard the birds faintly chirping in the distance and a light breeze here or there and just at, literally just the sun in the sky getting dark as the show went on. Oh. It was just a whole other piece of art that added something really amazing to the live theater performances that we were doing outdoors. Being able to do that outdoors for our audience was just something really amazing and something that everybody talked about. And now being able to do that in three different locations and allow more accessibility for more of our community to make it to some of our shows is just, it's really amazing. And I hope that as many people will take that chance and come out and check us out this year.
Renegade, I believe, is the name of the show that you're starting your season off with, correct?
Well, essentially, Renegade is version two of Terror.
Yeah.
What we learned when you're doing a new production, it goes through an evolution and you kind of put it into a workshop and then you get feedback and work on it again. And essentially that's what we've done with Renegade. But the wrinkle here is that the audience is the jury.
Right.
So that at our intermission, the audience votes. Innocent or guilty.
Okay.
And the second act changes depending on how the audience votes.
And it really was very amazing to watch people of all ages, families out there where there were children as young as 8 and 12 and 14, and then their grandparents and their parents or aunts and uncles. But just watching all of these families of all different ages contemplating what they thought was should be the verdict of the play. You know, it was very cool to just know that not only were we offering free live theater outside, but now we were sending these families home with something more to talk about and have something to engage with that was kind of out of the norm of just everyday life.
So we have that coming up fairly soon, right? Is it June or July that show is?
July.
July. Okay.
So we're doing all three plays at all three locations. So if people at a specific location want to see one of the other shows, they can come a different night and see that.
Okay.
But each location will get two shots of Terror, now renamed Renegade. And then we'll be doing two performances at each location of the Gin Game, and then this new property that we're putting together called Woodstock Ripples. So there'll be two performances of all three shows at each one of those locations.
Okay.
Catskill Brewery, Big Kev's Barbecue, and the Westinghouse Estate.
Great. And we also have something very special we were talking about as far as the Thursday night performances of some of these shows. Marshall, why don't you give us a...
Well, it's interesting. Because we're connected to these breweries, mm-hmm. and because we're doing a Thursday, Friday, Saturday run, on Thursdays at all locations, everybody that makes a reservation will get a free beer.
So let's talk about Bingo Bash, you call it, Buffet and Brews, with the entertainment of the show, right? And so when is that happening?
That's May 17th mm-hmm. from 1 to 5 p.m. And the day is, it's our Bingo Bash fundraiser, but we're also going to do a look back on our season last year. We're going to showcase a little bit of what we had going on for Terror. We're going to show a little sneak peek into the Gin Game. And we're also going to show a little bit about what's going on with Woodstock Ripples. We're going to have live music. We're going to have live theatrical entertainment and a whole bunch of really amazing bingo prizes for the attendees that were donated from local businesses. So we're very, very excited for that day as well. And that's May 17th at Bridge and Tunnel Brewery in Liberty.
Very nice. And that, again, is May 17th, 1 to 5 p.m. at the Bridge and Tunnel Brewery. It's located at 50 Lake Street in Liberty.
You can go to the site, which is www.catskillpublictheater.com, mm-hmm. and there's a link to buy those reservations or to buy the tickets for the Bingo Bash.
And that sounds like a lot of fun, too. Let's talk now about the Woodstock Ripples.
Well, you know, that kind of comes out of the fact that it seems that culturally, the Woodstock Festival, the original one in 69, I'd been thinking about perhaps trying to develop something original, and it just occurred to me that connecting up to the, not so much the festival itself, but the ripples that came from the festival. And there'll be a bunch of music. There'll be some immersive experiences for that audience as well.
So it's basically a multimedia experience.
So we've got some big video screens. And as part of the Woodstock Ripples performance, people get a chance to see never-before-seen photographs.
That's fantastic. And Ken, the Kev's Big Barbecue over in Bethel, when are we opening that up?
That starts in...
That's July 24th.
July 24th.
Okay.
At Big Kev's.
Great, great. And the Westinghouse Estate over in Goshen, when are we going to be there, Amanda?
That starts August 7th, and we'll be there through August 16th.
Very good. So plenty of time for folks to get out and see that. And of course, we can go to your website. Again, we'll give the name of the website for tickets.
www.catskillpublictheater.com. Theater spelled E-R, not R-E.
We can also be found on Facebook
okay.
as well.
Give us that address.
It's Catskill Public Theater on Facebook. Yeah.
Okay. So you get information about the shows, times, locations, ticket information on the Facebook page as well, correct?
Yes. Correct. So right. We're extremely grateful to be here in the beautiful Catskills and being able to provide Pay What You Wish live theater to the community.
Well, Marshall and Amanda, I want to thank you both for coming out here at our Liberty Studios and sitting down and talking with me. It's been a real pleasure.
A pleasure for us. And
yes,
we look
you.
Forward to seeing you at the shows.
Oh, I will be there.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to Tom Candela from Curtain Call. Tom, let's remind folks where they can hear your podcast.
Yes, you can go to my goodness.
A lot of W's.
Radio, WJFF Radio Catskill.org. Right? And you could find the, click on the community calendar there and find the podcast for Curtain Call. Right. And full episode of what you just heard will be on that podcast.
Today. All right. WJFFradio.org. Thanks, Tom. All right. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering four counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River.
riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
Next time in the New Yorker Radio Hour, Senator Alyssa Slotkin on what the Democrats misunderstand about Trump voters.
In Michigan in general, if you're not talking about the economy, you are literally having half a conversation. And I've had someone say to me, like, I can't pay for my kid to go to summer camp with democracy.
Michigan's Alyssa Slotkin, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Listen Sunday at 6 for the New Yorker Radio Hour on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Flood watch remains in effect as periods of rain continue throughout today. Rainfall around half an inch, some locally heavy rainfall possible. Today's high only 49. Few showers tapering off after midnight, low 41, and then sunshine tomorrow afternoon, a high 64, and a little warmer and sunny on Sunday, 67.